1956, I believe it was, God was working in the lives of five young men. He took a couple of them there a few years earlier, and they were working with some tribe in the country of Ecuador. And by 1956, all five of these young men had arrived in Ecuador, and they began a ministry. They began an outreach to the Alca Indians. At first, things went really well. They were extremely excited. They had made contact with these people. They began by flying over the village. They began dropping things in a basket. They would put stuff in a basket, and the pilot, Nate Saint, would fly in a circle to where the basket would almost stay in one place, which is quite a feat, in his little Piper airplane. And they would be able to get the stuff. The Indians would get the stuff out of the basket. And everything was going well. They landed along a riverbank at what they named Palm Beach, this little sandy area. And they made contact, physical contact with these people. Most of them had never had any contact whatsoever with a white man, with a Caucasian person. This tribe was known throughout the area for being extremely violent. Their answer to solving problems was always the same. Kill your opponent. They didn't take prisoners. They didn't take slaves. They killed people. But these five young men, Jim Elliott, Ed McCulley, Roger Gilderian, Peter Fleming, and Nate Saint, felt God's call on their life, as did their wives. And they had with them, several of them had children. And everything was going great. They were excited about the contact that God was providing, and the inroads, and the connection that was being made with these people. One day they were interacting with a man, a young woman, and an older woman. They named the man George. That wasn't his name, but that's what they called him. George. Okay, just making sure you're with me. And they had an interaction with these people, and all of a sudden the young lady yelled out something and ran into the jungle, and George followed her, and eventually the older lady followed her as well. And not too long later, a group of 10 to 20 men from this village came back to the clearing, and they killed the five men. And the last contact the wives had was with from one of the men who said, "We'll call you in 4 hours. Everything's going great." When they didn't call at 4:30, immediately the Ecuadorian Air Force and the U.S. military went and they scouted the area. And from the air, they saw one body on shore and they saw four bodies downriver caught in the thicket. And they had been speared and hacked to death. All these men were in their mid to late 20s. What a waste. What a waste that God would call five young men with a bright future, college graduates. One had been a lawyer who had been convinced by Jim Elliott to join him, to leave his career and be a part of this outreach. All of them had promising careers, lives ahead of them, families, young children. And God stirred in their hearts, and He directed them, and He brings them to this beach in Ecuador. What a waste. Or maybe we just need to take a step back and approach it from a different angle. What in the world is God doing? Either something's really twisted about God, and He doesn't know what He's doing, or maybe let's give Him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe He's just impotent. Maybe He can't control things like this. Maybe this wasn't His plan. Maybe He didn't foresee this happening. Maybe there was a blind spot that God had. And this wasn't His intent. As we go through the book of John, which is where we're at, we come to the middle part of chapter 6 this morning. I hope that it's already began to become clear, that it started to become clear in your head and in your heart who God is and how powerful He truly is. Nothing happens by accident with God. God is with nothing. He is intentional. And He is sovereign. Nothing catches Him off guard. There are no blind spots. There are no unforeseen moments that just slip past Him. We come to chapter 6 this morning, and it's a very familiar story to many people. It's kind of an amazing thing. It's one of those stories that gets a lot of press, because Jesus does, in fact, walk on water. You can go to YouTube and do a search for Jesus or walking on water, and you'll find all kinds of videos. Most of them, you'll find, are mocking the claim that somebody could walk on water. And the skeptic in us, in all of us to some extent, wrestles with that, right? I spent a lot of time this week, and some in Hawaii even, because we were at the water a lot, watching the waves, trying to imagine what it would actually look like. I watched the video, I think you showed part of the video from that movie of John. He referred to Evan Almighty, Bruce Almighty. You know, Hollywood tries to portray what it might look like, and all of our best efforts doesn't fully capture that moment. It's impossible to capture that moment of Jesus walking on the water. But what set that up? Why was Jesus walking on the water? Why were his disciples in the predicament that they were in? Why were they in a boat in the middle of a lake in the middle of a storm and Jesus walking to them? Does Jesus really know what he's doing? Is he really in control? The thought, the truth that I want you to take away this morning with you is this. Jesus does, in fact, dwell in the storm. Jesus dwells in the storm. He inhabits the storm. He's present in the storm to intentionally reveal the reality of who he is. Let me turn it on just a little bit. This is how God has spoken to my heart this week. You and I see Jesus in a way that we never see him outside of that storm while we're in the storm. You see aspects of who he is, you see qualities of him in the storm that you don't see when it's calm and when life is easy. So Jesus intentionally dwells in the storm to intentionally reveal the reality of who he is. Let me say it one more different way. We only get to see him for who he is in the storm. Now that presents us with a predicament, doesn't it? I'll be honestly. I'll be first to admit. Honestly, I really want to see Jesus for who he is. I really want to see him in his glory. I want to know him. I want to understand who he is. However, I don't want to live my life in a boat in the middle of a storm. So I'm faced with a predicament. I guarantee you that the wives of those five men did not want their young husbands to be hacked and speared to death and left on that riverbank. Jesus intentionally dwells in the storm, revealing the reality of who he is. Let me read to you, and I invite you to join me, in the book of Mark. This event is recorded in Mark, Matthew, and John. We'll go to John in just a minute. But Mark chapter 6, verse 45. If you have your Bible, open it with me. If you see your neighbor with the Bible, ask if you can share with them. There's some on the back table. And follow along in chapter 6, verse 45. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat. Immediately, referring to what? What did we look at last week? What did Jesus do last week? And don't make Matt feel bad because you don't remember what he talked about. He fed 5,000 men plus women and children. There were 12 baskets left over. Remember that moment? Immediately following that moment, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat. They're on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. If you're looking at a map, it's on the right-hand side is where this is taking place. He made them get in the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd, while he dealt with that crowd that had just been fed. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray, verse 47. When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. Read verse 48. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. About the fourth watch of the night, somewhere between 3 and 6 a.m., somewhere in that time frame, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. People don't walk on water. It can't be a real person. They cried out. They yelled, literally, because they all saw him, and they were terrified. Immediately, he spoke to them. I love that word immediately right there. You know why I like that word immediately? Does that not reveal to you the compassion and the understanding and the gentleness of Jesus? Now, come on. You're Jesus and you're walking on the water and these guys are freaked out. Let me make this a little personal. For those of you that are parents, you can reflect on moments where your kids are just like, ah, and they're all scared and screaming. Isn't that kind of fun? And aren't you a little bit slow to, you know, resolve the issue so they go, oh, okay. Isn't that fun? You know everything's fine, right? You're the parent. You're in control. You know there's no danger. If there's real danger, then it's not fun. I'm not talking about that moment. But you know everything's okay, and they're all freaked out and scared, and you're just kind of enjoying that moment. Jesus didn't do that. He didn't stand there and go, okay, you guys are scared. Man, I had no idea it would have this kind of impact. Immediately he spoke to them so they could hear his voice. And what did he say? Take courage. It is I. It's me. Don't be afraid. Then he climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down and they were completely amazed. For they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. It gives us a little clue here as to why this moment takes place. He had just fed 5,000 people from how many loaves? Matt? Five loaves and how many fish? Two loaves of fish. And there was 12 baskets left over. Now, it's easy for us to judge and go, well, come on, guys. Didn't I tell you something? Yeah, I did tell them something. But they still didn't get the big picture. They didn't get the complete picture. The hardening of the heart, the resistance is that if I told you right now to come over to my house and I'm going to walk across my pool, the vast majority of you would have hard hearts. You'd have closed hearts. You'd have resistant hearts. Right? You'd say, no, it's a trick. It's a trick. Well, they had seen the feeding of the 5,000. There's no question they were amazed. And they had been impacted by that. But Jesus knew that in their hearts they hadn't fully grasped who he was. And he sets up this moment to push them over that edge, so they would really see him for the reality of who he is. Jesus dwells in the storm to intentionally reveal the reality of who he is. Join me in the book of John. Join me in the book of John. John chapter 6. John chapter 6. Let me read these verses 14 through verse 21. John chapter 6. This is our text for this morning. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, verse 14, they began to say, what was the miraculous sign? Yeah, they just said all full. They saw that miracle and everybody ate. They began to say, surely this is the prophet. Now what are they referring to? They're referring to Deuteronomy chapter 18 where Moses promised that a prophet like unto him would come. That Jesus was that prophet. They're on the right track. He had come in fulfillment to that. But they were a little off track, too. Surely this is the prophet who has come into the world. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again into a mountain by himself. And when evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into the boat, and they set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, which is about halfway across the lake, Matt mentioned it's similar in size to Lake Tahoe, about 6.5 in that realm across. They're at the northern part of the lake, on the east side, rowing west, and the wind is blowing from the west to the east, directly in opposition to them. And so they're rowing, they've made it about 3, 3.5 miles. At this point, they've been rowing for about 6 or 7 hours in the storm. And they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water. And again, it tells us that they were terrified. So would you be slow to judge and quick to learn. All of us. Be slow to judge and quick to learn from these people. We're so quick to judge. I wouldn't have been terrified. I would have known it was Jesus. He had just fed 5,000 people. I would have got it. I would have been telling the other side, relax, it's Jesus. Be slow to judge, quick to learn. They were terrified, it tells us in verse 19. But he said to them, it is I, it's me, don't be afraid. Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore.
where they were heading.
Now, I want you to notice a couple of things with me from these verses. The first one is this. Jesus chooses our storms. Jesus chooses our storms. In the opening verses of that text, it gives us just a little window, a window that Matthew and Mark don't give us. And the window that we're given is this. Jesus sees this crowd, and this crowd is like, this guy is the prophet. This is amazing. He took 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he fed 5,000 plus people with them. He has got to be our king. He has got to be our ruler. And if he won't agree to it, we'll make him be our king. Both Matthew and Mark tell us that Jesus immediately got the disciples into the boat. In John, it gives us a picture of them being sent away, and they get into the boat, and they go across the lake. What's going on here? I believe what's going on here is Jesus is protecting his disciples from a storm, from a crowd that he doesn't want them to go through. He doesn't want them influenced by the attitude of these people. These people had just been fed, and that was in their heads and their hearts. They wanted Jesus for what he could do for them. We're not like that. I'm not like that. Are we? There's a danger in misunderstanding who Jesus is and looking at him for what he can give you rather than looking at him for who he is. Now, some of that comes from our own selfish nature. Some of it comes from false teaching. Incorrect truths. Some of it just comes from culture. And all those elements put together, we have this picture of Jesus that he's kind of there for us. And as long as he does for us what we want for him, we'll follow him. If he doesn't do what he wants for us, what was their solution? We'll make him do what we want him to do for us. We'll make him be our king so that he can keep feeding us and taking care of us. Do you see a problem with that picture? Do these people, have they surrendered to Jesus, the Messiah, Jesus, God, Jesus, the Creator? No, they haven't. Because you don't mess with the Creator. You don't mess with eternal God. You don't make him do anything. I want to read you the words of a man named William Barclay, who was a pastor and a teacher. He's long passed away, but he writes this. When we want comfort in sorrow, when we want strength in difficulty, when we want peace in turmoil, when we want help, when life has got us down, there's no one as wonderful as Jesus. Then we talk to him, and we walk with him, and we open our hearts to him. But when Jesus comes to us with some stern demand for sacrifice, some challenge or effort, with the offer of some cross, then we have nothing to do with him. When we examine our hearts, it may be that we find that we too love Jesus for what we can get out of him. And when he comes to us with his great challenges and demands, we too grow lukewarm, even resentful and hostile to this disturbing and demanding Messiah. That's the crowd. That's the attitude of the crowd. And Jesus, in his sovereignty and in his wisdom, protects his disciples from that crowd, that storm. And instead, he purposely puts them on a boat and sends them into another storm. Now, why is that reassuring, or is it reassuring? It's reassuring because Jesus chooses the storm. Now, if you're in a storm this morning in your life, I'll state what's already been obvious to you from the beginning. It rocks the world when you go through a storm. Now, when we make bad choices, we make sinful choices, and consequences come, we're usually at least pretty quick aware of that. We don't always want to acknowledge it or take responsibility, but we're pretty quick to recognize, I made some dumb choices and I'm in this mess. That's all we're talking about here. We're talking about a storm. We're not talking about a harvest or a reaping of our choices. We're talking about a storm that God, through his will, through his hand, puts you in. And if you're in a storm this morning, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Because when you enter that storm, one of the first thoughts is, what did I do? What did I do to deserve this? Why did this happen? And as we work through that, we come to this, I know I'm not a perfect person, but this is not of my doing. When the doctor says, I'm sorry, you don't go, well, what did I do to deserve this? Or that person comes out of the side street on a red light and destroys your life. What did I do? I didn't do anything. I had a green light. What is God doing? Why? The big question, why, begins to form in our head and in our heart. And there's no question in my mind that as these disciples in the middle of the storm, in the middle of this lake, at least some of them go, this is what Jesus said to do. This is where he told us to go. He told us to get in the boat and get across. We're here because of obeying what he told us to do. Hold on to this. Jesus chooses the storm. We don't have time to go into this philosophically, but the other half of the equation is that Jesus protects us from storms that he knows will destroy us. I'm convinced that these guys would have got sucked into that crowd, and Judas particularly. Yes, he's going to be the rule, and would have completely derailed what God was trying to do with his disciples in preparing them to begin his church. And he knew that, and he protected them from it. So it's obvious, right? It's in your head right now. If I'm in a storm, what you're saying is that Jesus put me in this storm intentionally. Yes, I am. And he intentionally keeps us out of other storms that he knows are not going to, we won't survive. Jesus chooses the storm. For him to dwell in the storm and to intentionally reveal who he is, he will put us in the storm that will accomplish that purpose. He'll keep us from the storms that won't fulfill his purposes, and all they'll do is destroy us. Again, obvious conclusion, maybe. If I'm in a storm, Jesus chooses the storms that he puts us in. I'm in a storm. I'm in the storm because he chose to put me in the storm. B, it's not a storm that's going to destroy me. You follow me? If in fact he is intentional, if in fact he is God, if in fact he is sovereign, and he intentionally puts these people in storms to reveal the reality of who he is, if I'm in a storm, it's from him, it's of his choosing, and it's not going to destroy me. Now, that's really easy for me to stay standing up here. It wouldn't be so easy for me if I'm holding the mast of this boat with the 12 disciples, you know, and I somehow get teleported into that scene. But okay, he's not going to destroy us. But it's precisely in the center of the storm that we have to come back to the reality, the truth of God's Word as it's revealed to us. And Jesus intentionally chose this storm for his disciples. Number two, Jesus comes to us in the storm. He comes to us in the storm at precisely the right moment. What is Jesus doing? Remember what he's doing? He's on land. He's safe. He's by himself. And he is what? He is praying. Can you just pretend with me for 1 minute? What is he praying for? What do you think? I got a number one on my list. What do you think he's praying for? Remember, we saw in Mark that he was on the mountaintop, and they're out in the middle of the lake, and it tells us that he, remember? He what? He saw them. He saw them, and what did he see them doing? He saw them toiling, rowing against the wind. He saw the boat in the middle of that lake. So what is he praying for? What? For them? Their hearts? Do you think, and I'm not trying to tell you this is what it says, This is divine imagination, or what do you call it? I don't like that word, speculation. It is speculation. Inspirational speculation, how's that? I like to think that he is praying for them. His heart is filled with them. And what he wants to see happen in their life, and what's about to take place. Father, protect them, hold them, work in their lives, make them ready for what's going to happen in this moment. Let it have the desired effect that you and I want it to have in their life. I think he's praying for them. It tells us that he waits until a certain moment. This is not chance. This is not, well, let's see. That's pretty bad. Okay, how about now? No, this is all under his will and under his control. Not only does he choose the storm, but he comes to us in the storm. At a certain moment in time, he stops what he's doing, he goes down to the shore, and he walks across the lake in the storm. And he comes to them. Now, I have only been in storms a few times. One of them is with my friend Charlie. They invited us for Thanksgiving. We went to Bodega Bay. We're in the house. All my kids there? Me and all five of my kids. They were much younger at the time. Becky somehow got out of it and stayed back with Barbara. Some excuse of cooking dinner or something. Charlie says, let's go out to the Bodega Bay and let's pick up the crab pots. So we get in his boat, which I'm sure to him is a big boat. It was a big boat to me, too, until I went through the storm. Now it seems like a really little boat. We didn't even leave the bay. We didn't even leave Bodega Bay. We get into the bay. All of my kids, except for Tyler, the girls are all huddled up, and they're all, like, locked into different posts on the boat. And me being spiritual, I'm praying, desperately praying, every minute in my head. God, and I'm counting. One, two, three, four, five. Tyler's got a hook. He's over there helping Charlie, and Charlie looks like Captain Ahab over there on the side of the boat, you know, and he's throwing out the hook, and the milk jugs, I think is what they are. Milk jugs are floating in the water. And I'm in the boat, and as the boat goes down, we go into the bottom of the swell, if that's the right word. All I can see is water. We're completely surrounded by water. And then you come up, and I could see out at the heads and the waves crashing on the rocks out there and just where we were headed. Big wave would come, and Charlie would stop what he was doing, he'd go to the thing, and he'd turn right into the wave. Now, I had some words for him in my head at the time, because I didn't know anything about sailing or boating, and he rode the wave, and the water would come over the front of the boat, and we'd go up the wave, and then we'd go back down to the next one. That's probably my worst case scenario of a storm, in a setting likely much worse even than what we experienced in Bodega Bay. Is this boat with these 12 men rowing desperately to get to land. It's dark. I don't know about anybody else. In Hawaii, I went snorkeling, way down, big fish, you know, the waves, and a little freaky, but it's kind of fun. It's a whole new ball game in the dark. I have a really hard time going in water in the dark. My mind plays games with me. I imagine things, big things, hungry things that are just below my little toes hanging down there, and they're gonna, you know, doing this type thing that's coming up. It's dark. It's cold. Likely there's moisture or rain in the storm. The winds would come down off of these 2,000-foot mountains that surround Galilee, the sea, this lake. The lake itself is 700 feet below sea level, almost a 3,000-foot drop. As these cold winds would come down, they would literally push the water, and these waves would go from west to east. Happen all the time. And they're in this little boat trying to go against those waves, against those winds, doing this, and it's dark. And all of a sudden they see a man. Now, I don't know how you see this in your head. I don't know if you've seen images of this. Let's throw them all out. Because again, I don't think there's any way to fully capture this. Imagine all you want. It's fine. I can't tell you exactly what it looks like. But if you can imagine the biggest waves, the howling wind, panic men, in the midst of that dark scene, the figure is walking on the surface of that water. Was he 2 inches below, like they always show us, you know, in the movies, or was he just, I don't know. But this is life and death for these guys. Don't forget these guys are fishermen. They know what they're doing. It takes a lot to terrify a fisherman. I found out. I was terrified. Pulling in the big cages, and Tyler's hanging over the boat, helping him pull in the nothing. Sponges, or, you know, and a few little crabs. We had a great meal of crab. It takes a lot to scare a seasoned fisherman, and they were terrified. Jesus walks in the water. Don't miss this. He comes to them. He chooses the storm. He puts them in the storm, and then it comes to them in the storm. Hold on to this. There is nothing that can keep Jesus from getting to you when you're in the storm. You don't believe me? Come on. You want to take my word for it? Turn with me to Romans chapter 8. I'll prove you wrong. Romans chapter 8. I'll let Paul speak on behalf of God. Chapter 8, verse 35. You there? Romans 8:35. who shall separate us from the love of God? Shall trouble? Shall hardship? Persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, or sword? There's some storm for you. As it is written, and now he's going to quote, for your sake, we, people of God, Jesus' followers, his disciples, face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, verse 37, no. In all of these things, in all of these storms, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. I am convinced. Does Paul have any credibility? If you know anything about Paul's life and what he experienced and the storms that he went through, he has a ton of credibility. I'm convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. You know what's interesting is that Paul himself, who wrote these words, went through a storm. And in his case, several, but the one I'm thinking of, his ship busted apart. And he landed stranded on an island. He was in the water, in a storm. And yet he still writes, there is nothing that can keep Jesus from getting to you in a storm. He chooses the storms that we are in, that he puts us in. He comes to us in the storm. And he challenges us within the storm. He challenges us within the storm. A.W. Tozer said that before God works mightily or powerfully through a man, he will wound him deeply. He will put him in a storm. He will put him through difficulties that will change him and shape him and mold him. Chuck Swindoll said it this way, very simply, God doesn't waste pain. He doesn't put you in a storm, as we talked about earlier, and freak you out to go, that's kind of cool. Look how scared they are. Look at the color of their faces. That's great. He never wastes pain. He puts us in a storm of his choosing, and he comes to us to ride through the storm with us, and then he will challenge us. He will change us. He will shape us and make us through that storm. Remember, they didn't get fully his intent from the feeding of the 5,000. Their hearts were still resistant. Something's not clicking yet. And he intentionally puts them in the middle of a lake, familiar territory, a storm, still familiar territory, but puts them in a place where all their best efforts can't get them out of it. He comes to them, and now he's going to challenge them. And the one maybe that stands out the most to us in this area of challenging, if you'll join me in Matthew 14, is Peter. I don't know if anybody connects with Peter like I do. Anyone? Don't be bashful. Raise your hand, you can yell it out. Matthew tells us his memory, one of the details that he includes in his recollection of this moment and recording it for us, is Jesus walking on the water, and Jesus saying in verse 27, Jesus immediately said to them, take courage, it is I, don't be afraid. Verse 28, who do you think speaks up? Peter. Matthew remembers this. Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water. This thing is sick. There is something twisted about this guy. There's something not right. Bill Cosby used to say that when I was younger watching his comedy. Something ain't right with this guy. They're in a storm. The winds are howling. The rain might be pouring. And they're rowing frantically to try to get to land. And this ghost shows up. They freak out. It turns out to be Jesus. He tells them it's him. And Peter says, well, if it's you, then they get out of the boat. And I hope you love Jesus. What does he say? Okay. Come on. Come. Verse 29. Peter got down out of the boat. Now there's a phrase, but hover there for a minute. It looks really easy, right? Just get down out of the boat. It's not easy to get out of a boat when the water's calm. You know, you've all seen the America's Funniest Videos, right? Where nobody seems to be able to get out of a boat without falling in the water. You're in a storm. And the swells are coming, and the boat's going up and down. And he gets out of the boat.
on the water.
Is that what it says?
No, it doesn't say he stood on the water. What does it say he did? He walked.
This morning, Morrison, my grandson, was down here, and he's just taking a few steps, and he's standing, and you got to do all this stuff. You got to distract him, give him stuff, and he, you know, has that look that 9-month-old, 10-month-old has. Can't use much stuff. And the first step is this. And he falls. And he gets up, and he does a few more things, and he's learning how to walk. I cannot imagine the sensation of trying to walk on waves and wind, and it's dark. Now, it tells us where his focus was at, doesn't it? Where was Jesus' focus? Let's read it. Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came towards Jesus. And as long as he was focused on Jesus, he walked on the water. It tells us that something happened, though. When he saw the wind, he was afraid. Why is he afraid? Hello? He's standing on the water. He's not in a boat. He's in the middle of a 7-6-mile-wide lake at night in a storm, and he's standing on top of the water. And when he takes his eyes off of Jesus and he looks at his surroundings, he panics. He's afraid. And what is your Bible? In your Bible, what does it say happened? He sinks. He begins to sink. He was afraid. He began to sink. And he cried out, Lord, save me. I think what he probably really said is, what am I doing? No, he didn't. He said, look here. Lord, save me. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and he caught him. And he said, you little faith, why did you doubt? Now, why didn't Jesus just let him sink? Wouldn't that have been fair? Yeah. Back to the parent thing, right? Yeah, you made your bed, now you sleep in it. You know, I'll reach down when you're about 5 feet under, and I'll pull you back up. Why? Because Jesus' intent is not just to choose the storm and come to us, but to challenge us in the storm. The storms that God places in your life and in my life are not intended to destroy you. He protected them from that mob, that crowd, that storm. The storms that he chooses to put you in are intended to challenge you, to shake you. Remember, it told us in Mark, the hearts are hardened. The storm is intended to break apart that hardness of heart, for you to see him for who he really is. This statement was stuck in my head this week. You never forget the lessons that you learn about Jesus in the storm. You don't. And I can tell you some. You can tell me. That moment at the peak of the storm where all hope is lost and Jesus comes to you and he takes your hand and he pulls you out of the water and you see him more clearly than you have ever seen him before. Sometimes you don't see him until the end of the storm. But I know this for certain from my own life. I never forget those moments. I never forget those moments of realization as to who Jesus is. And I see him for who he is in that storm. I don't see him when life is good and it's easy and my bank account is good and all the issues of my life are pretty stable. Oh, do I see his face when I'm standing on that water in the middle of the lake, in the dark, in the storm, and I'm sinking, and he reaches out his hand and he says, oh, why did you doubt, Kurt? Why did you doubt? What he said 5,000 people, Peter? He tells us that he got back in the boat. If you're in the storm, know that God chose for you to be that in that storm. Know that God will come to you if he hasn't already. He's on his way. He's walking across that water. And know that he wants to use this storm to challenge you, to change you, to shape you. And the way that's going to happen, this is the only way for you and I to change. Our sinful, stubborn people that we are. Here's how we change. When we see him for who he really is. And in that moment of seeing Jesus in the reality of who is he? He's standing on the water. He's standing on a lake in the middle of the night, in the middle of a storm, and nothing is touching him. Nothing is throwing him off balance. Nothing is scaring him. Nothing is hindering him. He's walking in the middle of a storm that the rest of us poor mortals are frantically trying to row across the lake. And he walks over and he takes the man by the hand and pulls him out and he gets into his boat.
you see him for who he is, you will be changed. You will be challenged. You will be saved. And that's why he puts you in the storm. It's not to destroy you. And lastly, Jesus carries you through that storm to dry land. It tells us in Matthew and Mark, all three have a little different way, but in essence what it just says is they are instantly on the western shore. He gets in the boat, it tells us that the storm dies down, and they're at their destination. That was his intent all along? Yeah. To get them to where he wanted them to be. And I'm not talking geographically. To get them where he wanted them to be spiritually, in their understanding of him. He carried them. They rowed for 6 or 7 hours against the wind and got to the middle of the lake. Jesus instantly takes them to their destination. He gets them there. It's effortless. It's not a problem for him. He will carry you to the dry land. He will carry you to the other side of the storm. These are on your study notes. I want to just mention them because they're key. Listen to him, obey him, trust him, and embrace him. That's what you need to do if you're in the middle of a storm. Know that he chose that storm for you. Know that he will come to you in that storm. He will challenge you and shape you in that storm, and he will carry you safely to the other side of that storm. He will not leave you in the middle of that lake to flounder. He will bring you to the other side. So how do you respond to that? You listen to him. He told them to get in the boat, right? And they listen. And you obey him. Go to the other side. You trust him. When he says, it's me, I'm here. You're in the middle of your storm, and your mind and your heart are racing, and you're trying to figure it out, and you're pointing fingers, and you're trying to blame, and you're trying to understand. In the midst of that storm, the voice of Jesus is saying, it's me. I'm here. Don't be afraid. And Matthew Mark says, take courage. It's me. I'm here. Trust him. And then embrace him. Invite him into the boat. Let him get into the boat. Or if you're Peter, which is some of us, get out of the boat and try to go to him. But either way, get close to him.